Our next speaker is Dr. Elena Bennett. She's an assistant professor in both the School of the Environment and the Department of Natural Resource Sciences at Mac campus. Before she came to McGill, she was involved in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. This is an international program to forecast the consequences of ecosystem change on human well-being. She was co-leader of the working group from that program that assessed future scenarios for ecosystem services, which is one of her areas of expertise. Today she will discuss what she describes as resilient agriculture.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Naveen, for setting up everything that people need to know so that I can jump right in and talk about it. I think Naveen did a great job of talking about agriculture and the problems that we face with agriculture. And I'm going to try to flip from there into saying why I think that agriculture has to be part of the solution. So agriculture, as you know, is very important. It has a huge footprint, as Naveen pointed out, occupying a third of the terrestrial surface of the Earth. Just a second. Sorry, let me just... Oh, you want me to talk to the mic? I can do that. There we go. Better. Perfect. Has a huge footprint on the Earth's terrestrial surface, and it also is very critical to human well-being. This might be because of the direct benefits of having food or because of the indirect benefits, things that Naveen talked about, like providing jobs and economic opportunities for economic growth and development. Okay, so agriculture is important. What's the current state of agriculture around the planet? Right now, we have many, many people who are still hungry. 1 in 7, over a billion people, lack adequate daily nutrition. We have a food system that we found out recently is not very resilient to shocks such as high oil prices. And we have an agriculture that's a major cause of environmental degradation, some of the things that Naveen has just covered for us. So the way that I'd like to reframe this problem is that I think we're facing a dual problem. We've spent the last 50 years or so stepping up agricultural production techniques through primarily intensification and some extensification in our attempts to improve our ability to feed the human population. But for one thing, it's not working. We still have far too many hungry people on the planet. And for a second thing, we're putting a tremendous stress on our environment by doing it. And the solution, I think, is in part about stopping our habit of considering agriculture as the problem and starting to look at how we can transform our methods of agricultural production into being part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. And that's going to require a radical rethinking of how we consider agriculture on the planet. We're going to have to stop thinking about solutions that are solutions to only one problem, to only water or only feeding the planet. And we're going to have to stop thinking about single frameworks of solutions. It's not enough to just think about organic agriculture or ecological agriculture. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So I want to start with thinking about how we can interpret this huge footprint that agriculture has. We know it covers a lot of area. We know it causes a lot of problems. What does that mean for quantitatively for the Earth's system? So the planetary boundaries that Tony mentioned in his welcome, they weren't developed, intended as a way to interpret agriculture, but they provide us a convenient means to do so. So they're a set of 9 processes that define a safe operating space for humanity. So these are 9 processes that have critical thresholds where we expect that if we cross those critical thresholds, we're going to have significant change to the Earth system. And they include a couple that are particularly relevant to agriculture, such as biogeochemical loading, changes in global nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. They include climate change, global freshwater use, and rate of biodiversity use. Those are 4 that I think are particularly relevant to agriculture that I'm going to focus on here. So those planetary boundaries concept was developed by Johan Rockström and colleagues. And then they went ahead and said, okay, so we've got these 9 processes that we think are important. Where actually are the boundaries? If we have to quantify those boundaries, what's the number that we put on that? And they did this for all of these 9 processes. I'm going to talk just about phosphorus just to give you an example. So they said the boundary here, the critical change that could happen if we cross the threshold is a global anoxic ocean event. So where phosphorus causes anoxia, deep water anoxia in the oceans. And they then said, well, we need to keep anthropogenic inflow at less than 10, at something less than more than 10 times the natural rate. We're currently at about 9 times the historical rate of phosphorus input to the oceans. And so they did this for all of these 9 processes. And then they also said, okay, so where are we at relative to those boundaries? Now that we know quantitatively where those are, where are we at? So here you're looking at those nine processes where the length of those petals describes the state of the Earth. And so you can see for some of those, they weren't able to quantify it. For some of those, we're well within this sort of green area of safety. And for some of those, notably the ones that are relevant to agriculture, climate change, changes to the nitrogen cycle, and biodiversity loss, we are far exceeding what Rockstrom and colleagues consider to be the critical boundaries for these Earth system processes. And we're close to exceeding it for the fourth process I want to talk about today, the phosphorus cycle. So once we know what these boundaries are and we know what the state of the planet is, next we can ask, so what's the role of agriculture in the state of the planet relative to these planetary boundaries? Is agriculture a big source of the problem or a little source of the problem? And I just want to talk about climate change. So agriculture is a source of a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. It emits more greenhouse gases than transportation, than industry, and than electricity. So agriculture here is a pretty significant part of the problem for just this one process. And that's true for some of the other processes that we're interested in, too. So for phosphorus, agriculture is responsible for 96% of all phosphorus that's mined annually on the planet. For water, agriculture is responsible for 70% of water withdrawals and 85% of consumptive water use. And for biodiversity loss, it's much harder to quantify, but I can say that there's a pretty broad consensus that habitat fragmentation, largely caused by land use change for agriculture and agricultural practices, is a major driver of biodiversity loss. So the answer here is that agriculture is playing a huge role in the state of the planet relative to our crossing these important planetary boundaries. Okay, so here's phosphorus, potassium, and nitrogen use for the last 60 years. So showing time, if you can see that, yeah, time here. And you see this vast increase, despite the fact for at least 40 years we've known that excess phosphorus is very problematic for freshwater systems. So why are we doing this when it's so obviously environmentally destructive? And the answer is, well, we're doing it because it increases food production. And remember where we started with the idea that food production is incredibly important for human well-being. So now I've got the phosphorus graph up here, and you're looking at wheat yields in developing countries through time, and you're looking at kilograms per hectare. So this isn't being caused by more land being put into production. This is being caused by our ability to use fertilizers to improve our ability to get yield. So we're doing this because food is important to human well-being, and we're driven by this need to produce food. Okay, so food's important for human well-being, and yet our attempts to meet our needs for food production are pushing us closer to, or in many cases, significantly past these really important planetary boundaries. So we have this dual challenge, this problem. We have to figure out how we're going to improve food security while we're maintaining a safe biophysical environment, while we're staying within planetary boundaries, or in some cases reducing the amount that we're already past those boundaries. So I want to start by admitting right up front, I don't have an answer to that question. It's an incredibly complex challenge, I think, for humanity over the coming decades to figure out how we're going to do this. I can say that current trends are not very promising. The current trends are that we are not going to be able to do this. And I want to share some of my thoughts on this topic about radical change in agriculture and how radical change in agriculture might be one way that we can get there. So there are a lot of proposed solutions to this agricultural problem of how we're going to feed the world and maintain a safe biophysical environment. So these are things like conventional agriculture. The solutions in conventional agriculture typically focus on sustainable intensification and resource efficiency. So this is how can we get more crop production for each drop of water? How can we get more production for each unit of phosphorus? They typically address one problem at a time, so they're focused on water, or they're focused on biodiversity, or they're focused on nutrient regulation, and they usually do this by using new technologies or using old technologies in a new place. There are organic agriculture proposed as a solution where we depend on management techniques rather than pesticides and manufactured fertilizers, hormones, and antibiotics. There is ecological agriculture, which typically focuses on ecological processes. So how can we use ecological processes to improve sustainability? This is things like integrated pest management, integrated nutrient management, integrating livestock back onto crop farms. There is traditional agriculture, which means reverting to an indigenous and presumably more locally adapted means of farming. And then there's a whole host of off-farm solutions, things like reducing waste, curtailing increased demand for meat. So this is sort of the set of what I would say are the proposed solutions to this problem that we have right now. And I want to put those in perspective and give an example focusing in on phosphorus, which is my favorite, personal favorite issue. So a conventional solution might be to improve phosphorus use efficiency, so get more crop out of each unit of phosphorus that we're using. Organic solution would be to limit fertilizer use. An ecological solution might be to reintegrate livestock, to use that manure as fertilizer instead of mining and depending on outside sources of fertilizer. A traditional solution might be returning to smaller farms with more diverse crops and more integrated livestock. And off-farm solutions include things like returning phosphorus that ends up accumulating in cities back to the farm. Great. So we've got lots of solutions. We've got this whole host, this whole range. Let's just put them in place and get on with it, right? Well, it turns out when we look closely that those solutions aren't really working. In fact, none of these dominant forms of agriculture is probably capable of providing food security while remaining within the planetary boundaries, although I'm going to point out why I think that there are important parts of the answer that are present in all of these different types of agriculture. Why don't they work? Here's what I think. They're often focused on solving one problem at a time. Some of these, what I'll call tribes of agriculture, are focused on either the environment or production, and the other is secondary. So they're really focused on increasing production of food, and if we can also improve the environment, great. Or they're really focused on the environment, and if we can improve production, great. That's not going to solve the problem, because the problem is that we have a dual challenge, and we can't solve one without solving the other. The other problem with this focusing on one problem at a time is that we solve one problem, but we make another worse. So Naveen really did a great job of pointing out this intensification-extensification debate and how our solutions to water problems are diametrically opposed to how we might solve the effects of biodiversity, of agriculture on biodiversity. The solutions are often overly focused on optimization, so really honing in and trying to solve that one problem the best that we can. There's very little allowance for new innovation. So we get this sort of tribalism where people back their favorite solution, whether it's ecological, organic, traditional, and they get sort of tribal about promoting only that type of agriculture and not looking to any of the other types of agriculture for any potential parts of a solution. There's surprisingly little monitoring of successes and failures. Each individual farmer is monitoring successes and failures, but they're not doing a whole lot of innovation. They're maybe making one major change per generation. And broadly, we're not monitoring where we're getting successes and failures. And when we do monitor, we almost never share information across regions, across types, across stakeholders. So farmers just aren't getting knowledge and information that's being generated in, say, experimental agricultural stations around the world. So if we think about what sustainable agriculture might look like, what are the pieces that we need to have in place? And I want to start moving towards talking about a solution. So we know that it has to be high yield because we have a billion more people that we need to feed and probably 3 billion more people that we need to feed by 2050. We know it has to be carbon neutral or better. We know it has to not overdraw water. It can't emit phosphorus or reactive nitrogen to other ecosystems. It has to be friendly to land and wild organisms, and it has to be resilient. So what are characteristics of a resilient solution? What is this going to look like? What are the pieces that we need to put in place, that we need to take from all of these different proposed solutions to the agriculture environment problem? We need bold experimentation and innovation. So we need to reorganize all of the existing building blocks that we have into new families of practices that meet multiple goals, in particular biophysical, geographic, and socioeconomic settings. And to do that, we're going to have to experiment to figure out what works and what doesn't. When we experiment, we need to monitor so that we are assessing where we have successes and where we have failures. After we monitor, we need bridging organizations that can transmit these successes from one location to another location. We probably need some creative destruction to maintain diversity and to avoid traps that are brought about by this excessive dedication that we find to one style of farming. So we need to let some things fail and to learn from those failures. And when we have crises, so when we have high oil prices or other things that create crises or create shocks in our food system, we should take advantage of those opportunities. There are solutions that we probably need to put in place that are going to be painful. And crises is a great opportunity to put in place some of those more painful solutions that people wouldn't accept under ordinary conditions. And finally, we need to reframe the debate. This is no longer about optimizing agricultural production relative to costs incurred on the environment. If we take that approach, which is the approach I think that we have by and large had up till now, we're going to end up trying to optimize and trying to aim for one solution. And if we aim for one solution and we get it wrong, we're in big trouble. Or if we aim for one solution and then the world changes behind us, we don't anticipate some change in the environment or change in the social situation, we're in big trouble. So I think we need to start thinking about reframing the whole debate around agriculture away from optimization towards a diversity of approaches. There's a lot of research we need to do to figure out how we're going to do this. So we need to improve, if we're going to take planetary boundaries as a way to understand what the safe operating space is on Earth, there's still a long way to go in improving our understanding of these planetary boundaries. It's a great start, but there's a lot we don't know. I think we need to map areas that are likely to cause us to cross planetary boundaries. So are there particular locations on the planet that are more of a problem than others? Are there areas on the planet that are particularly good? They're doing a particularly good job of farming well, and we should be learning from those areas and spreading that information to other areas. Understanding the impact of one solution on other boundaries, so we know that there are these interactions, but by and large, research has focused on one thing. So a person they focus on the impact of agriculture on water or the impact of agriculture on biodiversity. And as a consequence, we know very little about how those solutions and problems interact across boundaries. And we need to develop an understanding of multifunctional landscapes. And I want to turn to talking about some of the ways that research in my lab is trying to approach some of these, answering some of these research needs. So one thing that we've been working on is updating the phosphorus planetary boundary by taking freshwater systems into account. So I mentioned that the planetary boundary for phosphorus is based on limiting the possibility of an ocean anoxic event. And what we've done is said, well, what if we look at freshwater systems? Then what is the boundary for phosphorus? And we looked at three things. So we looked at input to freshwater ecosystems, we looked at phosphorus input to terrestrial ecosystems, and we looked at the amount of phosphorus that's actually in soil. Okay, so this is a little bit complicated. So we looked at two targets, one for freshwater systems, which is the leftmost set of bars in each color. We looked at one target for river systems, which is the middle bar, We did this with three different ocean inputs to the ocean, because that's a big unknown in our model. So that's the black has the highest input to the ocean, the clear has the lowest input to the ocean. And we did this for these three boundaries, for phosphorus in freshwater, phosphorus moving to soil, and phosphorus actually in the soil. And the key take-home message here is that the current amount of phosphorus in freshwater, the current movement of phosphorus to soils, and the current amount of phosphorus in soils exceeds the planetary boundary under all three scenarios of input to the sea, and under both the river conditions and the lake conditions. So we clearly have passed the phosphorus boundary already if we take into account freshwater systems in addition to ocean systems. So that's one of the things we're working on, is trying to understand planetary boundaries better. Another thing that we're working on in the lab is looking for places that are farming particularly well, or places that have particular problems. So this is some work that a PhD student in my lab, Graham McDonald, worked on, and he looked at phosphorus imbalances in the world's cropland. So in other words, where are we adding more phosphorus than we withdraw, and where are we adding too little phosphorus compared to the amount that we withdraw, where withdrawal is harvesting of crops. And we find that we're able to locate areas here in the red where we have very high surpluses. In other words, we're fertilizing way more than the crops are taking out in any given year. We find places where we have critical deficits, so where we're not adding nearly as much phosphorus as is being taken out of the soil by crop harvest every year. And from this, we can draw things that might be potential parts of the solution. So, for example, if we target a 21% reduction in phosphorus fertilizers in the areas with those most intense fertilizer-driven surpluses, so here showing the top quartile surpluses and the areas where fertilizer is a driver, if we focus just on those areas and redistribute that phosphorus fertilizer, we can eliminate all phosphorus deficits globally, and we can significantly reduce phosphorus surpluses in the worst surplus areas. So this is a way that we can, just by redistributing the current use, solve some of our phosphorus-related problem. And then we can look for areas that are farming particularly well. So these are areas that have high PUE, so high phosphorus use efficiency, which means they're getting a lot of crop production out of each unit of phosphorus input. So the brown are areas that are not doing that very well, and the green and darker green are areas that are doing that well. And we can identify particular areas that are getting a lot of crop production for each unit phosphorus and ask, what are they doing? Are they growing? Is it just that they're growing a particular crop? Is the management better? What's going on in those areas that makes them more successful at utilizing the phosphorus inputs that they have than in other areas? And then I want to talk about some work that we're doing closer to home. And part of, I think, figuring out how to make agriculture not just part of the problem but part of the solution is trying to understand how we can have healthy landscapes that produce multiple services that people value. So how can we design or develop landscapes that provide multiple services that people want to get, so that have places for recreation and that have biodiversity and that are producing critical ecosystem services. And I'm not going to talk about those results, but I'm going to plug a couple of talks and posters that are going to talk about those results. So Kate Liss, who's a master's student in my lab, is going to talk about the influence of landscape composition and configuration on ecosystem services. She has a poster over here that you should check out. Matt Mitchell has a poster also that's looking at how the characteristics of forest patches in the Monterey influence our ability to derive multiple ecosystem services from the landscape. And Kyle Martins is going to be talking this afternoon on bumblebee biodiversity around Mont Saint-Hilaire. So these are three ways that you can get more information about how we can develop multifunctional landscapes right here at home. So I think that how we're going to solve, we have this problem, right? We have hungry people. We've intensified and extensified agriculture. pretty much to the limit that we can do, and we still have all these hungry people in the world, and we're finding all of this environmental destruction that's the result. So how can we stop thinking about agriculture as the problem and figure out how we're going to develop agricultural landscapes that are part of the solution instead of part of the problem? And I think that we're going to do this by transforming agricultural systems in a radical way. We have a lot of solutions that have been proposed. There's a lot of parts of organic agriculture, traditional agriculture, ecological agriculture, even conventional agriculture that have a lot of important parts of this solution. And pulling these parts from these different tribes is going to be an important way that we come to a place where we can improve the environment and improve our food security. So I think we can, using those parts, we have this sort of vague picture of what the shape of this agriculture is going to look like, but we need a pretty enormous change to figure out how we're going to carry 9 billion people through the next century in a way that is safe and healthy. Thanks.
Do we have any questions for Elena? Yes, we do.
Both of our speakers raised very important questions on the matter of production and technical questions. But unfortunately, it seems to me what was not sufficiently addressed, although I realize time is a factor, are distribution problems, land ownership, marketing, pricing, etc. It seems to me that those factors are just as important as the production and technical questions, and they unfortunately are rarely addressed because they're much more complicated politically and economically than technical problems, and so they're generally left out, or they play a marginal role, and I think that it's time that somehow they were reintegrated into a wider discussion of how we're going to solve these food security problems for the human race.
That's a really important point, and you know, I think we've got a multiplicity of different potential answers, and part of the answer is going to be, you know, production and technical solutions, and part of the answer is going to be distribution, and it's going to require us to get outside of this sort of, you know, tribal beliefs in, you know, this is the answer and this is the only answer, to figuring out how we can work across disciplines and work with each other, because I don't know what needs to be known about, you know, say the distribution problem, but somebody out there does. And if we can figure out a way to work together, you know, then maybe we can move closer to that solution. It's important that we don't lose that piece.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I just had a very general question, but how would you respond if someone said that a focus on ecosystem services was one that created yet another tribe? Do you see it something that brings tribes together or yet creates another group?
Hey, that's my tribe you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think it's slightly different because I think it's a little bit of a meta approach. It's sort of saying it's like the planetary boundaries in a way that it's saying, how can we assess how well we're doing? So it's not saying, well, the only answer is, farm this way. Don't do no-till or do this or do that. It's saying, well, what we want is to get stuff off of this landscape, whether it's food or recreation or flood control. And so it's providing a way to quantify and understand what we're getting. And to me, part of the tribal problem is this sort of blinded focus on one thing at a time, and whether it's production or whether it's the water problem. And my hope is that ecosystem services sort of forces us to say, hey, these landscapes provide a lot of different things, and these blinders are really hurting our ability to push past that towards a solution, I hope.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Raf.
I'm interested in your focus on ecosystem services as what people want, and I'm wondering whether that also includes a desire on the part of many humans to preserve ecological services.
So let me ask you a question about the difference between ecological services and ecosystem services.
The distinction that I've generally seen would be that ecosystem services functioned to advantage humans and ecological services function to preserve biodiversity.
I see. Okay. So I think that ecosystem services, it's a really convenient way for people to look at it because it's what we want to get. But a lot of what we want to get is dependent on having what you're calling the ecological services in place. You know, we're not going to get, if flood control is important to us, we're not going to have flood control unless we have, you know, biodiversity and riparian, intact functioning riparian boundaries, et cetera. So I suspect that those sorts of ecological functions or processes or ecological services underlie the provision of ecosystem services. And to me, ecosystem services includes, you know, the stuff that we want, the food, and it includes all these sorts of regulations of disease and flood control and pollination and things. And it includes, you know, places to recreate and the sort of spiritual renewal we get from just knowing that there are wild places out there. So I think that we should start using that ecosystem services concept to encompass all of those things and to not forget that there are those processes and functions that are underlying them that are critical to producing those services, whether we understand that link or not.
Well, thank you. I'm wondering what you would suggest we should do where they might be diametrically opposed, though. I live on the waterfront. Obviously, flood control is important to me, but from what I remember, many freshwater fish in the Great Lakes St. Lawrence spawn on flooded land, and if we control those floods everywhere, they won't be spawning on flooded land.
Right. So maybe I can talk a little bit more about this project that we're working on in the Montérégie, where we're trying to provide some understanding for the people who are actually making decisions about managing the landscape about those trade-offs and interactions. Because quite frankly, we, by and large, we don't know. We know a couple of them, and we can all come up with examples of, oh, there's this trade-off between, you know, agriculture and water. But we don't know very much about how we get from ecological functions and ecological processes to the ecosystem services. And because we don't know that, we don't know very much about, we know what these trade-offs are, but can we change them? Are there trade-offs like that where we could actually loosen the tie so that it isn't a trade-off anymore? Or are there synergies where we could tighten the tie so that we get more services from a single landscape? But I think there's a tremendous amount of research to be done to get to the point where we can provide managers the information that they need to be able to say, hey, we want to develop a forest corridor. Where should we put that so that we maximize the synergies and get the services we want, and what places should we avoid? And I think we just aren't there with what we know in terms of trade-offs and how services are produced yet.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thinking of trade, isn't one of the issues that developing countries are increasingly producing products, crops for export rather than on local agriculture? And doesn't that mean that we're losing the ability, or developing countries are losing the ability to feed themselves, and we're losing local knowledge? I'm thinking particularly of Indonesia growing wheat for export and losing the capacity to grow locally adapted foods.
Yeah, so how do I want to answer that? I want to be sort of cautious because I think in some places that is happening where, you know, we're focusing in on growing for export, and sometimes that works great. You know, sometimes that actually is a way to put money in people's pockets and allow them to buy the food they need to grow. In other places, that doesn't work at all. I was just in a meeting a couple of days ago where they're talking about bringing mango growing to a particular part of Kenya, and everybody stopped growing the diversity of crops they were growing in their local households and started growing these mangoes that then all were harvested at the same time. Everybody had mangoes to sell. You couldn't get any money for your mangoes, and people weren't growing the food they needed to grow at home. So I think we're seeing a mixture of both that happening in some places, but in other places, and I can't think of a good example offhand, but places where it really is, part of what people need to be doing is diversifying and thinking about growing for export, but careful identification of where we should be putting in place each of those things and probably how we do both, right? We probably can't do all of one or all of another is going to be an important part of this diversity of solutions. It's an important point.
Okay, thank you very much. We will be resuming after lunch at 1:30. Thank you for your questions.